Okay, it's December 30th, 1997, and I'm with Lee Riley in his office at Cal Berkeley, the University of California, to continue his Pew Scholars oral history interview. And I wanted to follow up with some questions from yesterday's session. And one was, had you given any thought to returning to Japan for college or after you graduated to high school to return to Japan and pick up your life or get university education there?
No, not really, because I think by the time I was going through high school, I was already sort of, I think, slated to go to the States, and I never really... I wanted to go back to Japan for personal reasons, but not to go to university. Yeah, I think probably even now, Japanese university education is not the most, I think, enlightening system, and so, and you know, that was recognized even back then. So,
So you were, how aware of you of the differences between, say, going to the States for an education versus going to Japan for an education versus perhaps even choosing a European university?
No, I never even considered. It was just set to go to the U.S., back to the U.S. And so, you know, I certainly knew that, in at least in Japan, you know, you work very hard through high school, but once you start college, then it's a party for 4 years, because after the after the 4 years, you have to then, you know, start working.
Yeah.
So most Japanese, I think, students, you know, look upon their college years as a time to have their last freedom, and so, you know, of course there are many serious, you know, students who go to university, they're good universities, but I think it's not the most optimal system. So,
okay, and how aware of you living in Thailand were you that the United States, particularly California, was being pretty much split apart by these counterculture movements and the anti-war movement? The Vietnam protests, and how concerned were you to return to come to the United States, being an 17 or 18 year old in prime fighting condition?
We were aware of, you know, all the anti-war movements and all the sort of counterculture movements going on. I mean, it was, you know, in the media, even in Thailand. And also, you know, there were a lot of influences, because there were a lot of Americans in Bangkok. Many of them came to Bangkok, you know, as counterculture people to sort of hang around on the beaches. And so we saw them, I mean, so-called, you know, hippies. They were already in Thailand, not just from the States, but from Europe and, you know, other places. So, you know, we're quite aware of what was going on. But it didn't affect me in any way. And, I mean, I didn't even think about it in terms of whether how that's going to influence me coming to California. So, in fact, I was looking forward to seeing it more. And I mean, our high school was very American, and so even the so-called counterculture movements, there were counterculture types even in our school. You know, there were drugs, I think, you know, going on in the school. So I don't think it was that different from the typical situation, you know, that was going on in the States in high school. Many of the kids, you know, the military kids were there for short term, usually 2 years or so. And so there were a lot of exchanges of these students coming from the States. And so whenever that happened, they also brought the current culture in the States, music, you know, dance. I mean, everything was there.
And you had mentioned yesterday that you had got a high draft number, so it wasn't that much of a concern. But you know, how much did you ponder what you would do if you did get? I'm sure this happens a lot to Pew scholars in this time period. They considered what they were doing, and it I find it a bit ironic that you come to the United States when several of them were considering leaving the United States.
Yeah.
So how did you deal with this issue of, you know, registering for the draft and what you would do if you were called upon?
Mm. Well, since, you know, I was already in college when that was going on, you know, there's a lot of opportunities to serve as a conscientious objector.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, many of my friends actually did that. And I don't know how much you knew about that period in terms of these alternative arrangements, but it was not that difficult to get conscientious, you know, objector status. You can walk on campus in some you know, setting, and that could, those could count as a conscientious objector status. So,
yeah, is that what you registered as?
No, I didn't, but I can't remember what I registered as. But if, you know, that was the plan, that if I had a low number, that that's what I would do. I think I may have registered as a conscientious objector. I think you had to do it in order to get that. So yeah, my close friend did get a low number, but he, you know, served as a conscientious objector for 2 years, and he worked in, I think, in Stanford Medical Center or something, doing something. So.
Yeah, because there was a period of time when college deferments were not going to be accepted towards the end, but. And was that a concern for you? That.
That's right. Yeah, that was a concern. You know, there was a lot of changes, you know, in this draft system. And so early on, there was the deferment, and then they started going on the lottery system.
Right.
So these were, you know, very rapid changes. So
right.
By the time the lottery system got started, and after I went through it, you know, it wasn't an issue anymore. So.
Yeah. Okay, and you had mentioned that you would go back to Thailand during the summers, and that you saw things differently, that before you really didn't interact with the Thai culture all that much. You didn't really learn to speak the language. You really didn't see, kind of, in Bangkok, the differences between the social strata. And what changed between being a 17, 18-year-old senior in high school and then coming back during the summers?
Well, I think the Stanford experience, the anti-war, you know, movements and sort of the consciousness movement going on, you know, at Stanford.
There's
a lot of, you know, influence from just the politics as well as the sort of consciousness-raising movements going on campus, and you know, I was from Southeast Asia. I mean, I lived there for 4 years, not knowing what was going on in Southeast Asia when this was really the focus of, you know, all the American war efforts and things, made me quite aware that, you know, I really needed to know what was going on. People would ask me, you know, at Stanford, you know, what was going on, and it was embarrassing not having lived in Thailand right next to Vietnam, not knowing, you know, what was going on there. And so I think that really influenced, you know, my becoming more, making an effort, I guess, to really get to know Thailand.
Yeah. Okay. And so, how did you go about doing this? How did things change? You know, once you had this change in perspective, how did it look? Thailand looked to you then.
Well, you know, and I began to, I think, understand. I guess the role of, well, first of all, the Americans in Thailand, what they were doing there, and, you know, the relationship of the Thais to the Americans, and, you know, and then all the sort of the, people, I guess, who were not directly connected, you know, like the kids of the military, and how they fit into the whole picture. Whenever I went back, as I mentioned yesterday, you know, I taught English to the Royal Thai Air Force people.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, they were the Thai military, and they were obviously connected to the U.S. military. And, you know, we had very, you know, Thailand was not as repressive as some of the other, you know, countries. And so they were very free to talk about, you know, what was going on, and you know, I got a good sense of what was going on. You know, probably in a naive way, because you know, I'm still in my late teens, and but at the same time, by you know, teaching English to them, they also would invite me to, you know, to their homes and in countryside, and they would have parties, and you know, I got to know the Thai culture through them, not just the military, but you know, their families and in the other areas where you know they lived, and you know, I was also, you know, because I was a philosophy major, I also, you know, wanted to attend some of the Thai Buddhist you know, meditation mm-hmm. sessions, and you know, my friends, my Thai friends would, you know, take me to those places, and it's also I guess a mixture of a lot of different things, being exposed to different aspects of the Thai culture, from the civilian sort of life to the military life to the sort of the more spiritual life, and you know, and I traveled around the country, you know, during those summers, and yeah, so it was really just opening up my eyes and mind to the country that you know, that I had previously lived for 4 years, and, yeah, and yeah, trying to catch up.
And how did this kind of awakening of a consciousness or an interest in Thailand affect kind of your own relationship with your family, mm-hmm. given that your father was in, you know, very much involved in mm-hmm. the U.S. government mm-hmm. as a civil service member, mm-hmm. Procuring for the mm-hmm. U.S. Air Force mm-hmm. and being tied very closely to the military.
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess I was conscious of that, but that never really became a source of conflict. Although I remember one incident, you know, after college, I told you I went back to Thailand, and then I went to Japan.
Okay.
But I spent the summer before I went to Japan in with my parents, and I was actually going to, you know, continue to do study Eastern philosophy in Japan.
Okay.
So I had all these books with me, and right before, I think a day before I left for Japan, my father, look at my suitcase full of books from the quotations of Chairman Mao Zedong, and he proceeded to just confiscate that.
Oh, really?
And we had a big argument at that time, so I needed those books. But he would not let me take them, because I was going on a military transport from Japan to, I mean, from Thailand to Japan, and if he was concerned that if anybody saw those, you know, it would not look good.
And for him or for you? Or
probably for both of us.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, I was only using them, you know, for the purpose of, you know, studying part of the, you know, Eastern philosophy thing, movement in Asia. But you know, my father was really concerned.
Yeah.
I mean, he wouldn't accept my explanations.
Yeah. Okay. So
that, you know, so that there was that sort of thing, but not anything direct in terms of what he was doing.
Did you have the opportunity to discuss these issues with your parents?
Not in detail.
Yeah.
You know, my father and I actually went to Japan together. I remember he dropped me off in Japan. So he was obviously concerned, you know, I guess this was the first time I was going to be by myself outside of, you know, being in college.
Yeah.
And in during that trip, I think we talked a lot about a lot of other things that we hadn't really talked about. But it wasn't about, you know, his role in the Vietnam War or anything. It was more of a, I guess I was sort of criticizing him for being the way I was in the 4 years I was in Thailand, because my parents continued to sort of be isolated from the Thai culture, and you know, the newspapers that he read were American newspapers. And, so, you know, I was, I guess, being critical of him for not or being in Thailand but not.
Yeah. And what was his response?
He sort of took it. He understood it, and then when I came back, later, and so I mean, he had Thai newspapers. So
oh,
I mean, English language, but locally published papers, and so I guess he sort of took it seriously.
Okay. Okay. Well, to get back then to kind of your kind of intellectual development, I'm sure it's attached to kind of these other developments in terms of developing a consciousness and an interest in these other larger issues. Mm. I wanted to ask, how soon when you arrived at Stanford did you kind of lose this interest in physics and take up philosophy?
I would say maybe my sophomore year.
Okay.
I sort of started getting away from physics, started taking some philosophy courses, I guess, at that time. And then it was in my junior year that I decided that I wanted to go to medical school. So, I started taking, my pre-med courses towards the end of my junior year, so I didn't quite finish all of the courses to apply. So that's why I also wanted to skip a couple of years before I started medical school.
Yeah,
and so that was, so when I came back from Japan, after I went back to Stanford as a graduate at large to finish up all the pre-med courses.
Okay.
So, I remember very distinctly walking back to my dorm one day from one of my classes and deciding I wanted to go to medical school. So it was, I guess, like a very distinct, specific time of the day.
Yeah.
It was this one spring day, I think, I decided that's what I wanted to do.
And why was that?
I don't know. Just I guess because I had been thinking about it. And, I had also been in Thailand the summer before that. I came to the realization that if I really wanted to go back to Thailand and be useful, I couldn't do it as a philosophy person. It was not. Philosophy was, I think, even though I liked doing, majoring in it, it was too self-centered, I thought. I was only doing it for myself. So if I wanted to go back to Thailand to do something useful, I had to do something that was really useful, more practical.
Yeah.
So, it was not something that was, influenced by my parents or my friends or anything. I just made that decision.
Mm. And what did you see of yourself? In terms of, what would you, when going to medical school, would you become a physician?
Oh, excuse me?
Yeah.
Well, you were asking?
Yeah, I was asking, when you decided, had this moment, you decided to go to medical school, what did you see yourself doing when you returned to Thailand with an MD degree?
I don't think I had any specific idea of what I wanted to do. I wanted to, go back to Thailand as a physician. I was very naive, I really didn't know what. I didn't even know anything about epidemiology or public health at the time, and I didn't realize that, epidemiology is much, much more powerful in terms of being able to do something than just being a clinician. But my limited, sort of knowledge about medicine at the time was really clinical, and so I wanted to do something clinical, being a clinic or a hospital or a rural clinical setting and clinic setting and take care of patients. I think that was my sort of romantic sort of image. I get, sort of like Albert Schweitzer kind of approach to doing, working in a third world country setting. Which, later changed, obviously. I was also interested in, that in international health. It's really not so much, it's Thailand, but also international health. And, you know, I even thought of, you know, there were all these, Médecins Sans Frontières, the French group, you know, were in Vietnam doing things. And the American Rescue Committee, IRC, you know, also in Vietnam and also in Thailand when the Cambodians had to, they were forced out of Cambodia into Thailand. So those were the kind of, you know, images that I wanted to sort of fit into. And that's why I wanted to go to UCSF, because UCSF had an international health program. I didn't know if I was going to get in, but I applied to programs that had some international programs.
And which were?
Which were Cornell. Cornell had one. Although I didn't apply to Cornell. I actually ended up applying to Columbia. And then and Columbia had a limited international program and at that time. But UCSF was the big one. I applied to Stanford just because I happened to be already there. Applied to, I think, UCLA and USC. Trying to remember all the other places. I'm mixing up the residency with medical schools.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Which I can't remember which was which that I applied to. But
did you want to stay on the West Coast, or
let's see? I'm trying to remember. Certainly, when I was applying to residency, I wanted to go back east. Mm-hmm. But in medical school, I think I wanted to stay in the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. And why did you choose to continue with your philosophy degree rather than just drop that completely and pick up pre-medical studies?
No, because I had already, you know, taken many courses in philosophy. So it was a double major, pre-med, yeah. And you know, philosophy. I didn't have to do anything more to do it. So. And I wanted to have that degree, you know, after my name in philosophy. Because I guess at that time there weren't very many pre-meds or people applying to medical school with a philosophy major.
Right.
I think that helped.
Right.
Certainly helped.
And where was the issue of doing bench science? Did you have much opportunities to work in a lab at Stanford?
You know, we do, I mean, just the typical course bench work, but
yeah.
No. I never even considered doing bench science, even through medical school.
And
I was always interested in research questions. You know, whenever something came up, I would always think about a way of doing research to answer certain questions, but it was just always, it was just the way, I guess, my mind was working, but I never actually, you know, tried to do anything about it. Until I guess between my junior and senior year in medical school, I went to Thailand for an elective for 3 months. And then before I went, I discussed what I was going to do, I guess, with my advisor, one of my advisors. And, you know, it had to be a research project. And that was really sort of my first real research, kind of clinical research opportunity I had.
Okay.
And so, you know, I did that. But, you know, there was never bench lab science stuff. And that interest didn't really come up till much, much later.
Later. Okay.
I guess I've always been in situations where I'm easily influenced by the whatever I was doing at the moment. But at the same time, I try to then justify, you know, what I do, I guess, with what I've done previously, and try to synthesize all those things. If you know what I mean, you know. If I sort of break off I guess, ties with what I've been doing before, I feel like I've wasted that time. So I feel that somehow I have to incorporate what I've done in the past into what I'm doing now and try to build from there. So, and it turns out that's been very helpful to not forget about what I had done before into what I'm doing now. And it's much more time-consuming. It may be very inefficient to go about it that way, but they certainly help. In the medical school, you know, I was, I began to, I guess, appreciate or understand what public health could do. And I think it was towards, after I came back from Thailand, the elective that I decided I wanted to do some epidemiology, you know, and that's when I started learning about CDC. I didn't even know what it was, but I knew about CDC. And so when I started my residency, there were actually a couple of attendings who had gone through the EIS program at CDC, and they, you know, discussed with them. So when I first started my internship, my initial plan was to go to London School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene to get I forget the name of the degree they had, but there's a program for 1 year where you can do, you know, public health tropical medicine. Yeah. But that was also when Thatcher came in, and she actually raised tuition for all the foreigners to go to attend that school. I mean, before then, it was the same for everybody, all the fees. And so it suddenly became very expensive to go there. Yeah. And so I, you know, started thinking about CDC more seriously, and then I applied and got in. Yeah. So, by the time I was in residence, I was already really committed, I think, to go to, you know, do international health. And that's, in fact, you know, I wanted to be back east in Colombia again, being a sort of region where, you know, just being in New York City, you get exposures to international health type of activities. But my main reason for going back east was my girlfriend was at Yale at the time, so she was going to graduate school, and so she was, you know, from Stanford also, but she started graduate school at Yale and so wanted to be closer together. So. Yeah. Okay.
Usually obviously there's more practical. Well, to go back just a little bit, because I want to pick up with this philosophy that you have, how you do things, but we need to fill in a lot of gaps before we get there. Once you decided to go to medical school, did you decide to take the year off and go back to Japan?
Well, I had always planned to go back to Japan. Okay. I wanted to sort of pick up the language again. You know, I've lost the reading and writing ability a lot, and I wanted to pick those things up. And I also wanted to see my mother, my biological mother. Because that was sort of the real first independence that I had, you know. After I finished college, I was on my own, I can make my own decision.
Were you able to meet
her? Yeah, I met her. Not immediately after I went to Japan, but after several months, I decided to finally look her up. And you know, it was a very intense year in terms of making a lot of good friends. And, you know, just that 1 year, I still have very close friends. And, you know, I really got to know Japan again as an adult rather than as a kid. And yeah, you know, it's still emotionally. That's my home.
So. Yeah. Did you have to pick up your forgotten Japanese language, or
no? My spoken language was fine. It was more of my vocabulary. You know, I stopped going to Japanese school. As of fifth grade.
Yeah.
And so my vocabulary was really limited to up to fifth grade. So I was attending Waseda University, sort of as an exchange student, kind of a Yeah, and then trying to do Eastern philosophy.
Did you try and take any biology or pre-med?
No, there's all just the philosophy stuff. You know, it was only for a year, and I was teaching English, you know, to support myself.
So, and had you considered dropping the medical school idea?
No. Okay. That was the plan. So, you know, I was going to spend a year in Japan and go back to the States to finish the pre-med requirements and apply. So, but, you know, I didn't want to go to medical school right away.
And when you entered San Francisco UCSF, how aware were you that you had followed a maybe non-traditional path to get into medical school with all these maybe a couple of years younger, eager?
Actually, there were a lot of people like me who did that. A lot of people, in fact, maybe, you know, I can't remember what the average age was, but the average age of our class was certainly older than what he had expected. You know, they were at that time, there were people, you know, a lot of people who did things like this, you know, some who took off a lot longer than, a lot many more years than I did, you know, who had other professions. You know, there were nurses who, you know, who decided to go to medical school and came in. I think the average age of the women medical class in my class was, I think, in early 30s or something. So it was not unusual. I would say about one third, maybe even half the class, you know, had done something before they started.
And how did you adjust to the rigors of, you know, the first couple of years of rote memorization?
It was exactly that. it was like learning a foreign language, you know.
Really?
I mean, that was the way I looked at it. And something that was necessary, and a chore, and you sort of accept it and do it. But it's interesting. I mean, you know, I have a lot of friends from undergraduate period, but I don't have a single close friend that I can say is, you know, the acquaintances, but I haven't kept in touch with anybody from medical schools.
And why do you think that is?
I think we're so busy, you know, just doing things. You know, being medical students, that we just never had time to, I think, get to know. It may also be the way UCSF is arranged. You know, there's no dormitory there. Everybody's sort of scattered, living all around the city. Because the medical students I talk to at Cornell have a different experience. They really get close among themselves. Because they're required to stay first year, I think, in the dormitories, right across from the, you know, hospital. And so it may have more of that sort of thing rather than just the intensity of, you know, having to do work. But because of the intensity of work, you know, you're sort of scattered, you just never made an effort to get to know anybody. It's also, you know, possible, you know, there are the ones who went straight to medical school, many of them from the same institution, so they sort of knew each other from the undergraduate years, whereas I was 2 years sort of past, so I didn't really know anybody. I mean, even the ones from Stanford who came in, you know, I didn't know that class, so... I mean, I became friends with them because they had, they were at, you know, previously at Stanford, so, but they weren't my friends when I was at Stanford. You know.
At any point, did you think that you would do anything else once you did start learning more about medicine and clinical things, that you would do something else besides epidemiology or community health or international health?
No, that was
a surgeon and make lots
no,
of money.
No, I didn't want to be a surgeon. I wanted to do international health. Yeah, that was it. Epidemiology wasn't quite. Yeah, it hadn't blossomed in my head yet.
Yeah,
okay. In fact, the epidemiology course elective they had, it was so bad.
Really?
That, you know, I hardly went to class on that. So I actually had a bad image of what epidemiology was in medical school. It wasn't until much later. But I did have, you know, this strong interest in international health. And, Bob Goldsmith was my advisor. He was in the Hooper Foundation there, who, you know, had connections abroad. And, so he sort of he helped me to, you know, make the arrangement to the timeline.
Yeah.
I guess I also had an opportunity to get an MPH, you know, at the School of Public Health here. They had this joint MPH program. But it was either that or, you know, the elective in Thailand. I decided to do the elective in Thailand. Okay. I didn't have time to do both. So. Okay.
And at that time, how did you see the distinctions between, say, medicine mm-hmm. and public health, and how one defined those two areas?
I hadn't had any public health experience to really be able to think about that critically. But at that time, there was a lot of interest, which I guess, you know, is a resurgence of this now, in primary health care. In fact, UCSF had one of the strongest, you know, programs, I think, in primary health care. You know, they really started emphasizing that. That was sort of, I guess, my first introduction into prevention and that sort of approach to medicine, rather than more traditional treatment-oriented, you know, approach. I never really did anything specifically that got me exposed to those things. So, you know, other than going to Thailand. In Thailand, certainly I did. It was in a missionary hospital, but it also ran these outpatient, you know, services where they would go out into the villages with, you know, Land Rovers and open up these, you know, one afternoon clinics and see all these people with all kinds of illnesses. Monitoring for TB. They would bring these portable X-ray machines, and they also had a very strong birth control program run by head of the mission, the hospital, where, you know, they would go to these villages and give administer Dipo-Provera, you know, to women for birth control, and so there were these outreach services that, you know, I think it was pretty advanced, you know, for Thailand even back then. That really was my first exposure to sort of another aspect of medicine that, you know, I just was not exposed to at UCSF.
And was this project, did you initiate this project or
in Thailand?
Or was it part of an established, like, UCSF?
Yeah, it was already an established program. It was actually run out of UC Davis.
Okay.
But, you know, I did it through UCSF. It was essentially a clinical rotation in a missionary hospital.
Oh, yeah.
But you also had an opportunity to do these other things while you were there. So it's kind of a survey, you know, an exposure to working, you know, in that sort of setting. I also spent 3 days in a leprosy hospital, and that was also run by this missionary hospital. You know, you get this intense exposure to all kinds of aspects of leprosy. That was quite an experience. And, you know, the whole leprosy hospital was run by a couple of Australians, you know, who would come from Australia and spend a few months there, and then they would do this on a rotating basis. So. You know, you talk to these people and you sort of try to, you know, find out their motivation, you know, why they do these things. Like when I was in the missionary hospital, I had a American pulmonary physician, you know, who came from Arkansas someplace to work, you know, for a few months as a chest physician, offering his services, bronchoscopy services and things like that. And you really get to know these people. And then, you know, and then you really sort of admire them, you know, they become kind of a role model, because they sort of take the time away to do these things. And you know, as a medical student, you're very impressionable, and you sort of picture yourself doing that, you know, later on. So that I think that was sort of the beginning of this interest in public health. And public health approach to medicine.
And what were your concerns for yourself in terms of being exposed to all these diseases that mm-hmm. people in the United States only read about in history books.
No, I guess I was very naive. It didn't concern me at all. Yeah, I got sick, you know, a lot. Mostly, you know, diarrheal illness. But I had never, I don't think I even took shots before I went there. Because I had lived there before. I lived in Thailand before. And, you know, I was getting sick all the time even while I was living there before. Yeah. So it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, you think about it. You know, medical students always, you know, the medical student syndrome. You know, whenever you have something, you know, a fever, or you think of the worst possible thing that you most recently learned in class. And so, you know, I went through those periods in Thailand, but... you know, it was never a big concern.
And what was the reaction of your colleagues and you know, instructors at medical school who are practicing in a relatively safe area? Mm-hmm. And some had dreams of, you know, opening up their own private practice in Marin and having, you know, a fairly lucrative lifestyle. To people like you who were going off into the the wilds, practicing a different kind of medicine.
I don't remember any strong reactions one way or the other.
You
know, there were, I wasn't the only one, you know, who was doing that sort of thing. There were, you know, a group of us, you know, interested in this sort of thing. And so we sort of reinforced each other in our interest in these things. You know, there were a lot of people doing, you know, a lot of other things, not necessarily international health, but, you know, working in... free clinics, you know, here in the city, and you know, there were other alternative, you know, styles of doing medicine. There's people, you know, a couple friends who were like one of the first ones, I think, to start getting into sports medicine. You know, a lot of really creative people, I think, at that time, going into, you know, I think people going into private practice were almost a minority in our group. I don't think. Yeah, I don't remember anybody specifically saying that's what they wanted to do. Most of them, were, if they were going to do private practice, they were going to do primary health care, you know, type of work in some rural setting or some inner city settings. Or so it was an interesting class.
And how much of an, do you think, how much is it do you think, being at that time and place when... because when I was going through school, you know, people became physicians. I was a biology major that was not a pre-med, so therefore I was something odd. But all my colleagues and students who were biology major were pre-med, and they were all going into it because of the money. I mean, that's just, they could have a relatively nice lifestyle. And I don't know where the issue, maybe it was my own cynical view, but I was never sure where the issue of, you know, kind of promoting a better life for people in general or humans in general. How much do you think is that a product for you was a product of, you know, coming of age at a time when these issues were important during the 60s when love, peace,
No, I'm sure that had a lot to do with, you know, the sort of the attitudes of at least the people in my class, medical school. I don't think I remember anybody talking about going into medicine because they wanted to make money. I think that would have been very, very unusual at that time. I think most of them really wanted to, you know, do something, either go into academics, do really research, academic medicine, or, you know, work in some inner city setting or rural setting. And my roommate in the medical school went off to do Indian Health Service, and, you know, first in New Mexico, and then went off to Alaska. And it wasn't just as a payback thing to the public health service. He actually, you know, stayed and did those things. Yeah, maybe the residents that I worked with when I was a student, you know, one went off to WHO, and I don't know anybody who actually went into private practice for my group that at least that I, you know, I've kept up with. And so, and I'm sure that was a product of, you know, going through the Vietnam War period, and, you know, our decision, I guess the time when all of us made a decision to go to medical school, we're still in college during that period. But see, by the time we started medical school, the people who were going through college had already changed.
Right, okay.
I think that's when all the sort of intense competition for going to medical school started, I think, you know, where people would steal books and, you know, I mean, I had all kinds of stories about pre-meds at that time. Just, I think, I don't know if that was going on when we're going through a pre-med period, but I certainly don't remember the intensity of the competition.
Yeah.
But I did it sort of in an unorthodox way, too, because I didn't do it through, you know, the regular way.
Right. Okay, let me flip this over.
Mm-hmm.